Not ours, it isn't, Illich said. You will eat this now while I sit here and watch you. Then we will sit for another hour while you digest it. Or else I will call in Dr. Cortázar with a funnel and tube and we force you. Am I understood? Teresa took a forkful of the steak and put it in her mouth. Intellectually, she knew it tasted good. When she swallowed, Illich nodded. Again, he said. After he left, Teresa didn't move. She just sat on her couch, feeling the weight in her stomach. She hadn't eaten a meal that large in weeks, and it left her feeling bloated and wrong. Muskrat sensed that something was off and put her wide, furry head on Teresa's lap, looking up at her with complex brown eyes. Teresa put on a feed, the same one she'd watched as a child. The nameless Martian girl and the fairy named Pinsleep. Familiar images washed over her, bringing something close to comfort. A sense of predictability, at least. She knew that at the end, the nameless girl would escape Fairyland, that she'd go back to Innis Deep and her family, that in the last scene she'd pack away all her girlhood toys and leave for Upper University and an adult life. That was the sign that she'd won. She was free to make any life she wanted, and not be a prisoner of the elves. She lay down on the couch, resting her head on a pillow. The girl was taken in by Pinsleep again, and ran, and fought to escape, and escaped. Teresa started it again from the beginning. Prisoners and their dilemmas. She let the images play and took up her handheld. In her notes, she found Illich's old diagram. Teresa cooperates, Jason cooperates, Teresa 3, Jason 3. Teresa defects, Jason cooperates, Teresa 4, Jason 0. Teresa cooperates, Jason defects, Teresa 0, Jason 4. Teresa defects, Jason defects, Teresa 2, Jason 2. She ran her fingers over it. She'd forgotten that Illich's first name was Jason. She'd forgotten a lot of things. The puzzle, the unsolvable part, was that no matter what she did, it was better for the others to defect. If she was good, they should take advantage of her. If she was bad, they still should. And the same logic applied to her, except she hadn't done it. Everyone else had defected, and when she didn't cooperate, they forced her to. Even though the thing that made sense was to defect. Pinsleep discovered that the girl wasn't in her cell and screamed. Thin, fairy fingers balled in stylized fists. Muskrat snored deeply, her fuzzy body pressed close to Teresa. She put her own hand down and scratched the old dog, black with gray in her muzzle and at the tips of her ears. The thing she hadn't wanted to know pressed at her throat, welling up like a bubble rising from the bottom of the ocean. She felt like she could watch it come, and she knew that when it reached the surface, nothing about her life would be the same. Everything would have to change, because she'd changed. And it happened not with a scream, but with an exhalation. She leaned down, her lips almost against Muskrat's floppy ear. When she spoke, she whispered, "This isn't my home anymore. I can't stay here. I have to leave." Muskrat looked up and licked Teresa's cheek, agreeing. Chapter 41. Naomi. The Freehold Gate, like all the gates, was stationary with respect to its local sun. That it didn't fall into its distant star was just one of its many mysteries. But since they couldn't hook a chain between it and the Rossi and hang from it, they did not benefit from its gravity-defying properties. Instead, Alex parked the Rossi close to it with the Epstein drive on a gentle burn to balance the pull of the sun. The flight out to the ring gate had been eerie. The Rosinante had been her home longer than any place else. She'd slept more of her nights in these crash couches and eaten more of her meals in the galley. She had breathed the air that passed through the ducts and filters more times than she could calculate. Being inside the ship now, she felt the presence of the others, her memories of them. What surprised her most was that it didn't hurt. She'd left the Rossi not long after Amos took his covert assignment to Laconia. Alex was going to join Bobby on the Storm. Naomi, they had all thought, would hire on a temporary crew for the Rosinante and keep her flying. Only she hadn't. At the time, she'd barely been able to explain why. She could still remember some of the rationalizations she'd used. A gunship is harder to hide than one person. And the Rosinante has symbolic value as a prize that ups the risk of using her. And the underground on Freehold will be able to use her if the need for defense arises. They'd all been true, and none of them had. Looking back now, she saw that she'd left because staying would have been worse. She hadn't let herself feel the loss of Jim too deeply, or of Amos, or Clarissa. Bobby had invited her to join the crew of the Storm, but Naomi hadn't accepted, and Bobby hadn't pressed the issue. Now, strapped into the spider-like framework of a salvage mech and burning for the ring with her two transmitters and the spool of wire, she looked back at the ship, her ship, and it still ached. But it was bearable. She had taken her grief and locked herself away with it because she'd been skinless. It had been the best way she could find at the time to keep every new day from feeling like a little more salt on the wound. But that had been a different version of her. She'd grieved, but more than that, she'd changed. The woman she was now wasn't quite the one she'd been on the day that Jim left, or even on the day she'd chosen not to accept Duarte's invitation. Between the loss of Saba and Bobby's defeat of the Tempest, Naomi had been reborn so quietly she'd hardly even noticed. The only real evidence was that she could be on the Rosinante again. She could come home.
"You're almost there," Alex said. "How's it look?"
"Big," Naomi said. The gate was only 1,000 kilometers across. This close to the surface, it might as well have been half of the universe. This far from the sun, the mech's HUD needed to add some false color augmentation so that she could see more clearly what she was dealing with. She made her braking burn. She only had a little time before her orbit slid past her, but the transmitters were already wired together. She tapped through the initialization codes, and the compressed nitrogen thrusters took it from there. The primary transmitter shot out through the ring, and the secondary took up a stationary position relative to the ring gate, except for a slow drift that would eventually snuggle it up against the physical surface of the ring itself. As repeaters went, it was about the simplest version there was. One step up from cans and string. But it didn't have to last long.
"How's it looking?"
"I'm watching," Alex said. "I've got sync from the local side. I'm waiting for a response from... Yeah, okay. We're looking good. Come on back."
"Copy that, I'm heading in," Naomi said. "So much for the easy part."
"Take in what I can get."
Naomi turned back toward the Rosinante and started her burn. The mech had enough power in the thrusters that she could have worked out there for a few hours without any risk, but she was just as happy not to. The cooling on the unit wasn't what it had been, or else she was less tolerant of being overheated. By the time she'd gotten back to the ship, cycled through the airlock, packed the mech safely away, and floated up to the flight deck, the transmitter had been working for a little under 3 hours. The first cycle was passive, looking for signals coming from any ships in the ring space and identifying as many as they could. It looked like there were about a dozen at the moment, but all of them were recognizable as transport union or smugglers. Nothing had the comm signal or drive signature of a storm-class destroyer, and nothing was the Whirlwind. No ships at all would have been better. But this was as good as Naomi could have reasonably hoped. The connection request signal was the first real risk she was taking. If there were Laconian sensors in the ring space, this was going to give away what gates had active cells of the underground behind them. If things went the way she hoped, that information wouldn't matter much. It was a calculated risk. For almost a minute, there was no reply. The farthest gate was only a little under 1 million clicks. The light delay should have been nearly trivial. Naomi had a sinking feeling. What if they were the only ones? What if the plan had already fallen apart? And then the connection started coming through. First just one, then a handful, then a small flood. 53 answers in all. 53 systems with their full supply of ready warships, out of retirement and at her command. Easily hundreds of ships.
"Not bad," Alex said from his couch.
"It's excellent, until you do the math," Naomi said. "Then it's 96% no reply." But she smiled when she said it. Her plan, long since sent out via bottle and echoed from system to system, was larger than Laconia. Larger than the 53 systems that had sent ships for the fight. Even as she'd been setting out her makeshift repeater, an alert was going off at the transfer station on Ningjie Xin. A pirate was breaking into Laconian warehouses on the largest moon of the smallest gas giant in Sanctuary System. A massive data breach was being reported from the new shipyards in Yasamal System. Hopefully dozens of other small actions and issues, any place that a storm-class destroyer was in the system. After the death of the Tempest, Laconian forces and the factions that had thrown their lot in with them had to be nervous. That was her handle on them. It let her and her people distract them and draw them thin. They had to look strong now in every corner of the Empire, because they already looked weak. The next phase lost the anonymity and safety of the bottles. With a sensation like walking off her ship under an unfamiliar sky, Naomi chose the first of the connection requests and opened it. There was a hiss of static and the compression of sound that the multiple layers of encryption left behind.
"Nagata here," Naomi said.
"Zamarodi, back to you,"
Emma's familiar voice replied a few seconds later.
"We've got the Kama, a half dozen rock hoppers with rail guns mounted on them, and 10 anti-pirate gunships recently liberated from the Governing Council shipyard at Newbaker.
Ammunition?"
The lag was present, but not so bad that she had to trade recorded messages. The immediacy felt almost intimate.
"Oh, damn, knew I forgot something," Emma said. And Naomi heard the teasing in her voice.
"Of course we're loaded up. The Kama's got a full hold, too. Anyone needs resupply, we'll be there. Unless they kill us all, then not so much."
"Fair enough. Send me the specs and transponder codes. And what happened to Captain Burnham?"
"Early retirement," Emma said. "Cashed out and bought part of a medical clinic.
Probably smarter than all of us put together.
I'm leaning toward coward."
"Good to hear from you, Emma. Keep drives ready. I'll be sending a flight plan as soon as I have everyone."
"Standing by until then, Admiral."
Naomi dropped the connection and took the next. 8 ships with old-style stealth composites and internal heatsinks. They'd have been the kings of space a couple generations back, but they weren't bad even now. The next group had a Doniger-class battleship they were pulling out of mothballs. 250,000 tons of pieces smuggled to an empty moon and welded back together like a child's model kit with 1-to-1 scale. If she was lucky, there would be 3 or 4 more like it. Building them had been a pet project of Saba's. Saba, who'd started it and hadn't lived to see it through. These people she talked with, whose lives she was now in a position to risk at best, spend outright at worst, were Saba's network. They were the sword he'd dropped on the battlefield that she had picked up. 53 systems, 418 ships with 5 Transport Union supply ships and 3 Doniger-class battleships among them, and the Storm, still compromised, but able to fly, still on her way. The best hammer that the underground could put together. And it still wasn't half the size of the force the Tempest had killed in Sol. Hopefully, if she'd done this right, it would be enough. If she'd been fooling herself, they'd all pay the price. But she was pretty sure she was right. Once she had all the specs, she started sorting through by drive model, ship mass, and total energetic profile. Alex showed up with a tube of spiced lentils and a bulb of cold tea. She didn't know she was hungry until she started eating it, and then she was ravenous. She put the monitor aside, rolling the tube and pressing to get out every bit of the spicy, rich mush. When it was gone, apart from a burning aftertaste and a pleasant pressure in her gut, she sighed.
"Just like old times," Alex said. "You never could remember to eat when you had a good problem to solve."
"My old problems were never like this. It was more how to make sure we get to the next port safely."
"That's not what we're doing?" Alex asked with a grin.
"Nothing about this has any relationship to safety. This is exactly what I never wanted to be doing. Fighting? Getting people killed? I never even carried a gun."
"I knew that," Alex said.
And the grin had turned into something softer.
"There's still time. Call this off, head back to port, go back to getting our people elected into the Association of Worlds."
Naomi was silent. Her mind and her heart at odds the way they so often were. Alex misunderstood.
"I'm only half joking," he said. "There is time to pull back. We haven't committed these folks to anything. Not yet."
"No, we have to do this. If there was time, I don't know, maybe. Maybe I'd have kept looking until I found a better way. One that wasn't this." The comm controls alerted, a little orange strobe blinking with the incoming message. But it was only the Storm updating her ETA. Naomi tucked the empty food tube into her pocket. She'd throw it in the recycler when she was done here. The bulb of tea cooled her fingers and pulled a tiny sheen of condensation out of the air.
"You feel like you owe it to them?" Alex asked gently. "To Bobby and Saba, Amos?"
"No," Naomi said. "And not to Jim, either. This isn't guilt. It's possibility. I don't want to fight. I don't want anyone to get hurt or die. Not our side, not them either. I want to reconcile. That's why Bobby always got so frustrated with me. She wanted to win."
"Looks like you do too now."
"The problem is, it's hard to reconcile when you've lost," Naomi said. "Someone takes all the power, and you try to bring them into the fold again? That's capitulation. I don't think violence solves anything. Not even this. Not even now. But maybe winning puts us in a place that we can be gracious."
"Meet Duarte halfway?" Alex said.
She could hear in his voice that he wasn't convinced. If she couldn't sway him, maybe there wasn't hope. but she tried. Make space for him. Maybe he'll take it, maybe he won't. Maybe his admirals will see something in it he doesn't. The point of this fight isn't to kill Laconia. It's to get enough power that we can close the distance they opened between them and everyone else. That may mean punishing some people. It may mean answering for old crimes. But it has to mean finding some way forward.
You sure that's not owing something to Holden? Alex said. Because that sounds an awful lot like something he'd say. And then everyone else would roll their eyes at.
I don't know, she said. Maybe. There needs to be a Saba now. So I'll be that if I have to. But there's going to need to be a James Holden later. And if he's not there to do it, we'll have to pick that up, too.
What about a Naomi Nagata?
She should probably finish solving her traffic control problems. I don't want anyone going Dutchman. Or setting off another lost time incident. Not if we can avoid it, Naomi said. The comm alerted again, and this time she answered it. Rocinante here.
This is the destroyer gathering storm, a woman said. Her voice almost hummed with pride in the prospect of violence. Requesting permission to dock and transfer crew.
Alex raised a hand.
I'll take care of this one, Admiral.
Naomi transferred control to Alex.
Hey there, Jillian. This is Alex. You are good for docking, but make sure Casper knows to slide in from the side. It may not look like we've got the drive on, but we do. I don't want to prove it by cooking you.
Like your little drive could burn us, the woman said.
I'd feel bad about it, is all. I'll send the codes.
It'll be good to see you, old man, the storm said, and dropped the connection.
Jillian Houston, Alex said. She's a good kid. She'll make a fine captain.
I remember her father being an asshole.
She's also kind of an asshole.
It was 3 hours before the storm sidled up beside the Rocinante and extended its docking tube. It was strange seeing the Laconian ship with its alien technology, but also with the same design history as the Rocinante itself. Naomi sometimes forgot that Laconia was in so many ways the heir to Mars, until something like this reminded her. She was still putting the final touches on her transit orders when the new crew came over, and Alex had to prod her more than once to get her down to the airlock. He was right, of course. But the project was complicated, and so close to finished, it was hard to step away from it. The Rocinante had run for years on a skeleton crew of 4, and then expanded up to 6. It was designed for 22. The people who came in, drifting in the microgravity, were a mixed bunch, belters and freeholders, and a gunner from Brazil Nova who'd joined up on Ganymede. She greeted each of them as they came aboard, hoping that she could commit each name to memory and put it to the correct face later. Belinda Ross, Acacia Kinderman, Ian Kafilwe, Jonah Lee. She felt a little odd about the deference and formality in how they saw her. She was Naomi Nagata to them, and that meant not only their captain, but also the admiral of the fleet and the leader of the underground. They also knew her as Captain Draper's old shipmate, and there was a respect there she couldn't quite convince herself she'd earned. The odder thing was seeing Alex with them. One boy, Casper his name was, hadn't even come over to join the Rosie, just to see Alex. The admiration in the boy's face was impossible to miss. Watching them all together was like seeing an extended family that had come together for a wedding or a funeral. Alex hauled them all on a tour, showing them the Rosie. He called it an orientation, but it was more like showing off a prized possession. Or no, not that. A part of his life he'd only ever been able to tell stories about, and now could point to in the flesh. She made her exit as he was leading them down toward the machine shop, pulling herself up to the flight deck and her nearly complete work. The distraction of the new crew left her unmoored for a few minutes, finding her place and her train of thought. There was less to do than she'd thought. She put the final orders in.
"There is time to pull back," Alex said, in the back of her mind as the real one, Dex Below, showed his friends and compatriots something about how the Rocinante's PDCs reloaded, or the way the power grid had been rerouted to support the keel-mounted railgun or something. Somewhere far below, an unfamiliar voice laughed. This was what he'd done. Where Naomi had locked herself away, Alex had gone with Bobby and made himself a new crew, a new family. It amazed her that he'd done it so naturally that he didn't even notice. The only reason he didn't have a place with them was that he chose not to. Even this brief contact told her that they would have welcomed him. He'd built another place for himself in the universe. She hoped she wasn't about to take it away from him. She encrypted the orders, opened the broadcast, and sent them out. Chapter 42. Alex. Staging was important, but Alex hated it all the same. They didn't know what was waiting for them on the other side of Laconia Gate. For all they knew, the Whirlwind could be squatting just on the other side, ready to blast them all one by one as they came through. Sure, the intelligence they had showed it keeping close to the main planet, but that wasn't a promise. The faster they got through Laconia Gate, the better off they'd be. That sounded great until it meant trickling the assembled forces from 53 systems into the slow zone, bunching them together before the first one went through to Laconia, and then diving through the enemy gate one after another as quickly as they could without vanishing. Then it got a little nervous-making. "Was it always like this?" Ian, the new Comtech, asked. He was a freeholder, born and bred. Draper Station was as close as he'd ever been to another system.
"Casper said it used to be different."
"That's true," Alex said. "It used to be different." The station at the center of the slow zone was growing darker as the days and weeks passed. It had cooled from a point of sun-bright whiteness to a threatening shade of orange. The surface of the slow zone that had been black and featureless still had the strange aurora look. If anything, that seemed to be getting brighter.
"This is the Deliverance," a voice said from the open comm channel. "We have completed our transit from Hamshalim."
"Copy that, Deliverance," Ian said. "Benedict, you're clear for transfer."
A few seconds.
"This is the Benedict. Copy that. We are starting our burn." 200 of the ships had already come through. Like the Rossi, they were making their way to the Laconia Gate. The others were still stacked outside their gates with Naomi's transition order. Without Medina control to keep anyone from going Dutchman, they had to rely on her for their script. Which would work as long as not too many other ships came through in the same time frame, and as long as the behavior of the gates hadn't changed. That wasn't the slow zone's only new risk, though. Alex could still remember coming through the Sol Gate the first time. Back then, the slow zone had been a place of mystery and terror, alien artifacts and death. Before Medina, he'd have said that the decades had tamed it, made the place into something known and understood. That it was capable of changes they didn't understand tore the scab off that wound every time he thought about it. He kept reaching for the drive control, wanting to edge the ship out through the gate just a little faster, a little earlier. He was heading to a battle with a vastly more powerful enemy, but at least that was known. Being reminded that they'd been building roads through a dragon's mouth left him jumpy. That was the thing about hubris. It only became clear in retrospect. "This is the Benedict. We have completed our transit from Hamshalim.
Copy that, Benedict, Ian said. Chet Lam, you are cleared for transit.
Alex reached for the drive controls, pulled back.
You okay? Ian asked as Alex unstrapped from his couch.
I'm going to get some tea. You want some tea?
I'm good, Ian said, and Alex pushed off for the lift. He wished they were under burn, not only because he wanted to get out of there, but because being on the float made moving through the ship too easy. If he could feel the effort of motion, maybe it would do something for his anxiety. As it was just having an itch he couldn't scratch. In the galley, he pulled out his hand terminal. There was one message in his outgoing queue, flagged to hold. He braced with his right hand and foot and spun his terminal slowly in the air like a pinwheel while he thought about it. The display, reading his orientation, flickered to keep up with its own rotation. After a few seconds, it started to annoy him. He grabbed it again and opened the message. His own face appeared on the screen. His voice came from the speaker.
Kit, I'm about to do something, and it seems like I might not come back. It's risky, anyway. And the last time I did something like this, I thought about you a lot afterward. I know me and your mom didn't get along there towards the end, and maybe I haven't been as good a dad to you as I could have been.
He stopped the playback, looked at it for a long moment, and deleted it without sending. There was this idea that one message could change a lifetime of decisions you'd already made. The truth was, he hadn't said anything in there that Kit didn't already know. If Naomi's plan worked, Alex could go back and say anything that still needed saying in person. If it didn't, it was probably better for Kit not to have had communications from his rebel pilot father. Belinda and Jonah came in together with the subdued glow of two people who've been enjoying each other's private company. Well, they were in the hours before action. Alex could still remember a time when he'd taken some comfort that way himself. They nodded to him, and he nodded back like he didn't suspect anything. Truth was, as long as it didn't affect the ship's function, a little affection in the crew was probably a good thing. Holden and Naomi's relationship had been the unstated center of the Rosie crew for a long, long time. That was part of why losing Holden had broken everything apart. Now, here he was, and here was Naomi, back in the ship, doing something dangerous. It almost felt like old times. His hand terminal chimed. It was Naomi.
Admiral, he said.
Captain is fine.
Yeah, okay, he said. Felt weird saying that anyway.
So, I'm about to do a thing.
A thing?
Speechy, rousing the troops thing, admiral of the fleet kind of thing.
Ironically,
Alex said with a laugh. This is serious, Naomi replied, but there was no scold in her tone. We're three transfers away from having the whole fleet in here. I've sent my group assignments to the other ships. I thought I should make a statement, something to the crew. Did Bobby do that? Alex had to think.
Sort of, you know.
I was really hoping you were going to say no.
Nervous?
I think I prefer being shot at.
Well, if this goes well, you'll get to confirm that. So, that's a plus.
Might be.
Okay, I'm on my way up.
Alex took a last long pull from the bulb of tea and tossed the rest into the recycler, then pulled himself back to the central shaft and up toward the flight deck. He felt his anxiety starting to shift, but he wasn't sure yet what it was becoming. Maybe excitement, maybe fear. By the time he got to his couch, Ian wasn't on the open comms anymore. The kid looked grim. Lips pressed thin and fingertips dancing at the edge of the control monitor, like they were looking for something to do there. Alex gave a thumbs up as he strapped in. He didn't know what he meant by it, apart from general emotional support. Naomi sailed onto the deck.
She was in formal blacks that looked like a uniform without quite being one. Against it, her gray-white hair didn't look old. It looked striking. Her face was serious and hard, her movements fluid and strong. She pulled herself into her crash couch, pulled the tactical readout to her station, and looked over the data there. Her ships, her fleet. Every eye on the flight deck was pointed toward her. She glanced at Ian. "Open shipwide," she said.
"Yes, Captain," Ian said.
Naomi cleared her throat. It echoed through the ship. "This is Naomi Nagata," she said. "We are about to make our transit into Laconia. We will be going into the heart of enemy territory. We all saw what the Tempest did to the inner planet's combined fleet. I know that's in your minds now. It's in mine, too. But what we're doing here is different. We were not able to stop the Tempest when it invaded Sol."
"Stop the shit out of it later," someone shouted a deck or two below.
Cheers and hoots followed, but Naomi ignored them. "We aren't trying to stop the whirlwind. We're trying to move it. How exactly this will play out is going to depend on what we find when we get through that gate. The exact tactics we will be figuring out on the fly. The grand strategy, on the other hand, is set. We're going to destroy Laconia's construction platforms. The tool Duarte has used to make the Magnetar ships, to make Storm-class destroyers, to generate antimatter. All of that ends now. And with that, Laconia's attempt at empire. We are going to do that. Every ship in this fleet has a part to play. The most dangerous role is the actual attack on the platforms. With luck, that will be us. Our battle group will be the Storm out of Freehold, the Cassius out of Sigurtar system, and Quinn and Prince of the Face out of Haza. 5 ships, but we won't be alone. Every ship, every battle group, every member of every crew will be at our backs. This will be a long fight. It will be hard, but it will be won. So if you need food, eat now. If you need to visit the head, you have 5 minutes. After that, we're going through." She killed the connection to the sound of cheers. On the float, there was no way to sink back into her couch, but if she could have, Alex was pretty sure she would. He pulled up his controls, selected the course profile he'd already laid in, and typed in a message to her.
"That was good. Did everything it had to."
It popped up on her monitor. She smiled thinly. A few moments later, he got her reply. "I hate public speaking. Hate it. Next time, you do this part."
"Get me a next time," he typed, "and I will."
Her laugh was barely a chuckle. It was a victory getting her to relax even that much. It was strange seeing her in Bobby's role. It was stranger to realize that in his mind, it was Bobby's role, not Holden's anymore. He wondered what else had changed while he wasn't watching. "All right," Naomi said loud enough for the flight deck crew to hear. "It's time. Alex?"
"Aye, aye, Cap,"
Alex said. He triggered the acceleration alarm through the whole ship, waited 20 seconds for any stragglers to get into a couch, and the Rossi jumped up, eager as he was. The gel of the crash couch pressed back, cool against him, and he felt himself grinning. His HUD marked the pathway to the gate, and he started wondering how bad it might be on the other side. As the fear of staying in the slow zone faded, the fear of leaving it for Laconia ramped up. Behind him, another ship's drive bloomed. The Storm, and then the Quinn, the Cassius. They'd timed it all out to the second. He felt the needle, and then the surge of the juice. It was a hard burn for him. It was going to be hellish for the Belters, for Naomi. He kept his eyes on the drive status, on the maneuvering thrusters. They were making the transit much faster than usual, and a misfiring maneuvering thruster at the wrong moment could throw them off course and into the swirling nothingness at the edge of the slow zone. He didn't know whether that would be a good death or not, and he wasn't interested in finding out. Without visual telescopy, the 1,000-kilometer circle of the gate wouldn't have been more than a speck on the monitor before they were already through it. Almost before he could register the passage, the Rossi's thrusters fired. The crash couches didn't hiss so much as click as they snapped to his right, and then sharply back again. Alex's vision clouded a little at the edges, the blood in his brain stirred by the shifts of inertia. The first thing was enemies. The Rossi's radar was already sweeping the system, her telescopes looking for the drive plumes and her radio array listening for the transponders of Laconian ships. Already 5 had lit up, but they were identified as transport union ships with legitimate business in the system. There weren't very many points of interest in Laconia's system. It was still too new for the spread of human stations that Sol System had. There were some, though. An ice moon around the system's single gas giant had a scientific outpost on it. One of the inner, rocky planets had been mining titanium for half a decade. Rumor was that Duarte had set aside one of the Ceres-sized dwarf planets as the site of a massive art project that was underway. The first real enemy the Rossi found was almost halfway to the Empire's home. A pair of storm-class destroyers already burning out toward the gate. And then, behind them, close to the planet, the unmistakable heat and energy signature of a Magnetar-class battleship. Alex pushed his fingers to the control pad at his side and typed out a message. "No guards at the gate. They didn't see us coming." A few minutes later, Naomi managed a reply. Or they couldn't imagine anyone being this dumb. He would have laughed if he could catch his breath. They'd been at 8 G's since they came through. He'd done worse, but he'd been younger when he did it. The storm, Quinn, Cassius, and the Prince of the Face were all behind them, their trajectories making a thin fan pattern. At the gate, the first of the Doniger-class battleships emerged into normal space and angled off at a vector different from their own. The threshold level on Naomi's model dropped slowly on his screen, measuring mass and energy and safety. The moment it was low enough, the second battleship arrived. The light delay from the ring to Laconia was almost 3 hours, so everything they were seeing in system was from the past. But it also meant that the closest Laconian ship wouldn't know the enemy had arrived for a little over an hour and a half, and Laconia proper twice that. Alex didn't let off the burn. By the time the response came, their fleet needed to be scattered as far through the system as it could be. If it had been football, Laconia would have had a world-class goalie and a couple of professional strikers against Naomi's team of 400 grade school children and 3 Doniger-class football hooligans. Any head-to-head battle was a win for Duarte. So it was better that there not be any. Not until Naomi could pick them. Alex switched over to visual telescopes and looked back at the receding gate. It was already tiny, but he could make out the drive plumes of the emerging ships when they came through like new stars being born, and behind them, the real stars and the wide, beautiful smear of the galactic plain. The same, more or less, as it always was. 3 hours later, the enemy destroyers killed their drives. Light delay meant that they'd seen the intrusion into their space and reacted, and the evidence of response was only just arriving. Alex wondered if they'd cut drives when they saw the Rossi come through, or if it had taken a few unexpected drive plumes lighting up their gate to make them nervous. If he'd cared enough, he could have done the math and figured it. He did enough to know that the news of their appearance hadn't reached Duarte in the Laconian capital, and that it would very, very soon. In his couch, Ian grunted. For a moment, Alex was afraid it was a medical problem. Some people reacted pretty badly to their first extended high G burn. But then the message came from Naomi. Drop the burn. We have a message. Alex thumbed the Rosi back down to half a G. All around him, he heard the others gasp and sigh. He did a little of the same himself. Kefilwe, Naomi said. Let's have that message. Yes, Captain, Ian said. To your station? I think we'll all be interested. A woman not much older than Ian appeared on their monitors. She had sharp features, pale lips, and the blue uniform of Laconia, and her forehead was furrowed, confused, not alarmed. This is Captain Kennedy Wu of the Laconian destroyer Rising Shamal to the unidentified destroyer and its escort. You have made an unauthorized and unscheduled transit into Laconian space. Please cut your drives at once. If you are in need of assistance... Someone behind Kennedy cried out in alarm. Alex thought they said, It's the storm, or That's the storm. Something along those lines. The Laconian captain's concern changed to fear and anger in a heartbeat. Alex tried to put himself in her place. The stolen ship that had murdered the pride of her navy, killed the unkillable, and was now showing up where it had no business being. He and Naomi knew all their antimatter supply had gone up with the tempest, but he watched Captain Kennedy wonder. Attention, gathering storm. You are to cut engines immediately and surrender control to me. Any attempt to approach Laconia will be treated as hostile and met with immediate and... A different voice called out. This time, Alex was sure of the words. More contacts. This one's big. That had probably been one of the Doniger-class ships coming through. Captain Kennedy looked away from the message, checking something on another monitor, and the message ended.
Well, Alex said, I think they noticed us.
Got to think High Consul Duarte is going to be having a distressing day, don't you? Ian said. Naomi pulled up the tactical display. The vastness of Laconia system simplified so much that all their ships pouring through the gate were a single, minuscule yellow dot. Orders? He asked. They're coming for the storm first, she said. Bring us on a slower burn toward the gas giant, and get me a tight beam to Captain Sellers and the Garcia y Vasquez. We'll make it look like we're open for a fight there, and the Neve Avivim can burn like hell to get around like they're going to make it a pincer. As soon as the destroyers commit to that, we'll change it.
Copy that, Ian said.
Behind them, another ship came through the gate. Hundreds of drive plumes arced in shallow curves or wide, spreading like dust in a high wind. The siege of Laconia had begun. Chapter 43. Elvie. If she could have, Elvie would have moved her work someplace else. A lab of her own would have been best, her rooms with Faez a damned close second. But the data was at the university and the pen, so that was where she went. And at first, she resented it. The breakthrough came when she could finally put aside Cortazar's work on changing Duarte and get back to her own data. Her reports from the dead systems felt like letters from a past life. The breathlessness she'd felt upon realizing that there were literally rains of glass on the one semi-habitable planet in Charon seemed almost childish now. She looked back at it and saw her own wide-eyed wonder, and even felt an echo of it. The massive crystal flower, with filaments running through the petals like vacuum channels, gathering the energy of Charon's system's wildly fluctuating radiation and magnetic fields, like daisies collected sunlight, if daisies had been thousands of kilometers wide. She still thought the crystal flowers could be a kind of naturally occurring interstellar life, and the massive green diamond... She looked at that one for a long time, before she understood what she was really thinking. Then she took a tablet with the readouts and data to Cortazar's private lab. She hated being in the room with him, hated having him at her back, but she didn't have an alternative.
Yes, Kara said, when she looked at it with her flat, black eyes. I know about that.
Zan was sleeping, or resting with his eyes closed, which was probably the same thing from where Elvi sat. Cortázar at his desk scowled at the two of them, Kara and Elvi, leaning against different sides of the clear plastic cage like girls comparing lunches at university. He went back to eating a sandwich with an air of disapproval.
Is there anything you can tell me about it?
Kara frowned. Even that had a moment of extra processing that went into it. Like the girl, or the thing that had been a girl, needed to remember how to make movement first. Or maybe it was more like a kind of gross motor stutter. Elvi really needed to get back to that line of research at some point.
It does record, Kara said. That's not the right word. It's not like memory, exactly. It's more like everything all at once. Like the way a film is all the pictures that tell the story, and they're all there, even when you only see one at a time. I'm not explaining this right.
A gestalt, Elvi said.
I don't know that word, the girl said.
Her hand terminal chimed, at the same moment that Cortázar's system threw an alert on his monitor, Trejo informing them of an emergency meeting in his offices in half an hour.
Problem? Kara asked.
Too many masters, not enough time, Elvi said. I'll be back when I can.
Cortázar was already heading for the door. She had to trot to catch up. A driver waited for them outside, managing to look obsequious and impatient at the same time. A cold wind was blowing in from the east, stinging Elvi's earlobes. It was her first winter on Laconia, and she understood it was likely to get a lot colder for a very long time before the warmth came back. In the back of the car, Cortázar folded his arms and scowled out the window. The city was glittering, and there were banners up for some kind of cultural celebration. Elvi didn't know what it was. The streets they passed had people rushing down them in thick coats. A pair of young men ran alongside their car for a moment, hand in hand and laughing, before a security guard in Laconian blue waved them off. It was hard for her to remember that a whole population, millions of people, was spread across the planet, living lives in a new environment, while she tired her head in reams of data. In that, it felt a lot like pretty much every other city she'd spent time near.
I heard you talking to the older subject, Cortázar said.
Right, Elvi said. This is awesome.
She lowered her voice, roughened it, and put on a fake Martian accent.
We thought it was two cases, but it's been the same case all along.
Then, when Cortázar didn't respond, like Inspector Bilgun, how he and Dorothy were always on different investigations and it turned out they were related.
I never watched those, Cortázar said. I'm concerned about how you're treating the subjects.
Kara and Zan?
You treat them like they're people, Cortázar said. They aren't.
They aren't rats. I've worked with rats. They're very different.
Again, he didn't get the joke, or didn't think it was funny.
They are mechanisms created from the corpses of children. They do some things that the children did because those are the parts that the repair drones had to work with. Eros was only different in scale. The nature of the protomolecule and all the technology related to it has the same logic. On Eros, when it wanted a pump, it co-opted a heart. When it needed tools to manipulate something, it repurposed a hand. This isn't different. Kara and Alexander died, and the drones made something out of the dead flesh. When you talk to that girl, she isn't there. Something is, maybe, and it's made from parts of a human the way I could stitch together a model catapult from chicken bones. You're anthropomorphizing them.
Is that a problem?
It's inaccurate,
Cortázar said. That's all. At the state building, an escort led them to a conference room where Trejo and Illich were already sitting. Illich looked worse than usual, and the way things were, that was saying something. Trejo, on the other hand, seemed almost at ease. He gestured at the chairs, and Elvi and Cortázar sat. A display on the wall showed a map of the system, sun, planets, moons, and ships, like a virtual orrery. It seemed to her like it had a lot of ships in it.
The research? Trejo asked curtly. Where do we stand?
Making progress, steady progress, Cortázar said.
Do you concur, Major Okoye?
We're finding new connections, she said. You don't really know what's critical and what's just nifty until after the fact. But sure, progress.
We've had a development, Trejo said.
What's up? Elvi asked.
That was how she learned that the underground had launched a full-scale invasion. Trejo brought them up to speed as quickly as he could, then opened the floor to comment.
The thing I care about, Illich said, is what they know that we don't. That's why this is a problem.
I understand your concern, Trejo said, one palm up as if to say, please stop whining.
First, they all saw the Tempest stand up to their fleet. They knew what it was capable of. And we saw them destroy the same unkillable ship. We don't know what else they're capable of.
The readings from Sol are consistent with the full complement of antimatter resupply we sent having been used, Cortázar said.
And there isn't any more missing, Trejo said. All that still exists is either being isolated on the construction platforms or was shipped to bomb ships and other systems. It's possible that they've been appropriated by the enemy since the loss of the Typhoon, but we haven't heard of any that have gone missing.
So, if it's not that, Illich said, then what is up their sleeve that they're willing to throw 300...
400, Trejo said.
More came through. 400 ships at us. Because unless they've all suddenly become suicidal, we have to assume they know something.
Elvi tended to agree with Illich's point, if not with his tone. She also understood why Trejo seemed more at ease. After all the alien strangeness and political intrigue, a nice, simple shooting war was a move back into his comfort zone. Not into hers, though.
You let me worry about that, Trejo said. I've already been in touch with Admiral Gujarat. The Whirlwind's still not at 100% readiness, but she's comfortable taking it out so long as it stays in system. I have no interest in putting our last Magnetar through the gates anyway. We're ready for this. What we aren't ready for is the High Council's silence.
Would seem strange, Cortázar said.
Leading a secret task force focused on the things that killed Medina is plausible, Trejo said. Reassuring, even. Staying silent in the face of an invasion is not. We need his face on this. No options.
I'm not sure how we do that, Elvi said. He hasn't had a really lucid moment since we make it, Trejo said.
I understand that this is a little below your collective pay grade, but I'm not interested in bringing a media team into the fold. We'll scan the High Council, get recordings of his voice, and generate a message to enemy and empire. You have some experience with imaging, yes?
I've run a bunch of animals through sampling pouches, Elvi said. It's not really the same thing.
We can make it work, Illich said. Good. Trejo said, and stood. For a moment, Elvi thought the meeting was adjourned and started to head for the door herself.
Dr. Okoye, we're not waiting on this. We're doing it now.
The scanning device wasn't particularly bulky, but Duarte's room wasn't built for it. Kelly had dressed the High Consul in his formal uniform and was helping him to his chair. The thought, as Elvi understood it, was that if they scanned the uniform into the same profile as the man, creating the false version would be simpler.
There are going to be forensic traces, Cortázar said.
There always are. We have very good imaging programs, Trejo said as he tried to fit the lighting stick into its base. Other people do too, Cortázar said. I'm not objecting to the plan. Just be prepared to discredit the people